Today is October the 17th, 2018. Do you know who has your personal data besides Facebook and Google? Let me ask the question a little differently. Do you know who's using your personal data? Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Podcasts of the program is available on wbai.org/archive, prn.fm, and on our website, pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York on the radio and prn.fm on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program, except when WBAI is in a membership drive, the programs are different. WBAI is in a membership drive this evening, and our program has been preempted. More than half of all the calls today are, well, they're robocalls, and it's annoying the public, like, what can we do about it? While smartphones have become more advanced and sophisticated, almost all of them aren't that smart in protecting the users from one of the most basic yet, and also the most dangerous threat to all, and that's the nuisance phone calls. These calls range from simply annoying prank calls to dangerous phishing scams, and while there are apps that try to detect and curb those scammers, they have always have ways of getting around it. That's why one of Apple's latest patents tries to cut the scam at the root by trying to identify it even before it reaches your ears. Scammers and criminals have also gotten more sophisticated in their tools and methods. Their strategy often involves modifying data headers that accompany each phone call to mask the source of the call or to use a different number to get past phone screening apps and services. And that's why if you say, do not call, it doesn't matter. You don't have their number and you can complain, but there's no way of stopping them, at least not that we know of now. As with hackers, it's always a game of cat and mouse, and Apple, the cat, may soon have an edge in this round. As with anything involving networks and networking infrastructure, the patent is a bit complicated. It involves using parts of the headers, the session initiation protocol, or the SIP identifiable headers that spoofing callers can't modify. These would, in turn, identify the real source of the call, whether it's passed through a forwarding device or whether it's really coming from someone in the user's address book. The Apple patent, well, we may not see the light of day on it, as this one might be even more harder to implement. It pretty much requires the cooperation of telecommunication companies to work, and while Apple may have some clout in the industry, such a system will also require support from governments, which it doesn't always get. Let's hope in this case, let's root for Apple to be able to get this patent not only accepted, which it has, but also to get it implemented. And CenturyLink was recently awarded a patent that focuses on blocking unsolicited robocalls. They were awarded a patent this week for technology related to blocking unsolicited calls. It's a growing issue among consumers who have logged millions of complaints with the Federal Trade Commission over just the past 1 year. And depending what CenturyLink does with their patent, robocallers who have been warned about dialing numbers on a do not call list could face fines and the victims of the call could see a credit on their bill. The patent is a continuation of other CenturyLink patents that focuses on blocking unsolicited calls from caller ID spoofing auto-dialing devices. CenturyLink is looking to take the national do not call list to the next level for its subscribers. According to the patent, the technology essentially creates a personal database that subscribers can add unsolicited calls to by entering a predetermined code and hanging up. If the call doesn't qualify for an exemption, like a political call or a volunteer organization, the number is added to the internal no-call list database. If it's the first offense, the unsolicited caller would receive a warning. If the offender makes more unsolicited calls, they could be fined and possibly disconnected from the service. The victim of the unsolicited call would also receive a credit. In 2017, the FCC reports reflect that American landline and wireless subscribers receive an estimated 30.5 billion, that's a B, 30.5 billion illegal robocalls. That number was up from 2016, when 29.3 billion robocalls were made. The FCC estimates that the number could hit 40 billion for this year. In its July 2017 application for the patent, CenturyLink claims that no other service provider is currently offering a personal no-call list that allows subscribers to add, remove, or manage unwanted calls. Let's hope that they share this patent with other phone companies and the public can perhaps rest at ease that most of these calls can be prevented. Wow, 40 billion calls. The competition in smartphone product sales has lost its focus. With all the new advances in the smartphone, the camera is getting all the attention with upgrades. Samsung has announced the new Galaxy A9, the first smartphone in the world to have four rear cameras. Huawei P20's Pro and the LG V40 Thin Q both have three rear cameras, and the latter has a total of five, including two cameras on the front. By the way, the accurate description is the smartphone has a camera with built-in multiple lens. It seems adding eye-catching features like an abundance of cameras make these mid-range handsets more appealing to a larger audience. Samsung Electronics adopted this strategy, and the A9 is aimed at the Instagram generation. Its four rear cameras include one main sensor, one telephoto sensor that offers optical zoom, one ultra-wide sensor, and a depth sensor for Samsung's live-focus portrait effect. However, Google thinks a second lens is unnecessary for the Pixel 3's main camera. Google unveiled the Pixel 3 phone and the Pixel 3 and Pixel 3 XLs, would feature a single camera on the back and two on the front. Why is there a dual camera in the front? Google's explanation is that its sole purpose is to let people capture wide-angle selfies without the help of a selfie stick. Boy, that's progress. Nokia is creating a handset with five rear lens. Adding more cameras simply won't make much of a difference to the majority of people taking photos. With Google, they have added new camera tricks, which includes a flicker sensor to prevent flicker effects under certain indoor lighting and an AI photo processor it introduced last year. A surefire way to stand out in the phone market is to add more cameras. While Samsung and Apple dominate the premium market, it's more difficult to stand out as a mid-range phone like the roughly $700 A9. The phone is locked into an advertising battle of which smartphone can take the most amazing photo. We are at the point where adding more cameras simply won't make much of a difference for the photos that we take. Little by little, smartphone manufacturers are doing their best to turn the army of smartphone-toting consumers into a band of full-blown mobile photographers. As our devices today struggle to push their technical feature sets any further, manufacturers have made it clear that they're in a race to create the most over-the-top smartphone camera system known to man. The smartphone cameras have come a long way since they were first introduced about 10 years ago. Single-lens smartphones with single-digit megapixel count and a digital zoom have been replaced by the multi-lens systems that are capable of optical zoom and more shooting modes than the consumer public cares to count. The smartphone is evolving into a camera-first product that happens to support a ton of apps and can make phone calls and send and receive texts. Whereas computing systems and peripherals have come down in price with added features, the smartphone have been the exception in which price has been heading into the opposite direction, and that's because of all the added sensors. Let's get real. $1,500 for a device primarily for telephone calls is over the top in product design. For half the top-end price, you can buy the same quality device for telephone and still be able to use it as a GPS, FM radio, internet access, texting, and supported apps. You can buy a separate high-end digital camera for the difference in price that will outperform a high-end smartphone with a gaggle of camera features. The smartphone camera arms race has gotten out of hand. For 80% of pictures you take, the basic smartphone with a simple camera function is more than adequate. And when you do need Ceylon quality pictures, then carry with you a compact digital camera that has real zoom. But that's not even the craziest thing that smartphone cameras have been reported to be included with features. Back in August, digital imaging startup Light has a 16-lens camera in its arsenal, and it has announced plans for a 64-megapixel smartphone sometime before the end of the year. That product doesn't have an official price tag yet. However, according to the Washington Post, it could set you back over $2,000. Seeing and reading that kind of smartphone news is exciting, and it creates a sort of wow moment. But more so, I'm left wondering why. Why is a 9-lens smartphone or even a 4-lens one necessary? Who makes up the target consumer for devices with multiple lens trying to function as a zoom lens? A majority of users are never going to get the most out of these camera systems. It may be overgeneralization, but the typical user finds themselves in a situation where they need to quickly get their phone out and capture some moments quickly. So why all this fuss? Is it a bunch of smoke and mirrors to get users to forget about the fact that these are phones? Is it pure revenue play in order to drive up the price of the smartphone even further? Hey, you the consumer, get smart. PC sales up, smartphone sales down, and tablet sales falling like a rock. Earlier this year, I commented that with the fourth quarter of last year, the sales of PC did a turnaround. Now Gartner confirms that worldwide PC shipments grew for the first time in 6 years. Their data, however, does not include Chromebooks. According to preliminary results by Gartner, this is the first quarter of year-over-year global PC shipment growth since the first quarter of 2012. PC shipment growth in the second quarter of 2018 was driven by demand in the business market, which was offset by declining shipments in the consumer segment. Data includes desktop systems, notebooks, PCs, and ultra-mobile premiums such as the Microsoft Surface, but does not include Chromebooks or iPads. In the consumer space, the fundamental market structure, due to the changes on PC user behavior, still remains and continues to impact market growth. Consumers are using their smartphones for even more daily tasks, such as checking, social media, calendaring, banking, and shopping, which is reducing the need for a consumer PC. With the completion of Lenovo's joint venture with Fujitsu, 3 out of 4 PCs, or 75% of all PCs, were shipped by the top 5 PC vendors in the second quarter of 2018. With the inclusion of Fujitsu's PC shipments due to the joint venture, Lenovo was in a virtual tie with HP for the top spot in the second quarter of 2018. The statistics are based on shipments selling into channels and do not include direct sales by manufacturers. In the US PC market, the industry returned to growth after 6 consecutive quarters of shipment declines. In the second quarter of 2018, US PC shipments increased from the same period last year. HP Inc. was the market leader in the United States. In the United States, business PC demand was particularly strong among the public sector. Overall, Chromebooks grew 8% in the U.S., but Chromebooks are not included in the PC market statistics. Most of the Chromebooks were sold in the education sector. Moving to third quarter results, Lenovo now has retaken the top spot in PC shipments. It's also Microsoft's first time in the charts. The Chinese tech firm has reclaimed the top spot for PC shipments in both Gartner and IDC market share estimates for the third quarter of the year, pushing past HP to scoop up roughly 24% of the market. Analysts attribute this to a smarter North American strategy. For most others, though, the season was a mixed bag. HP and Dell boosted their shares slightly year over year. However, Apple and Asus saw their shipments drop. Though Acer's results depend on who you ask, but it's still lower than last year. The market leader is now Lenovo, followed by HP and Dell, with increase in PC shipments. Apple is fourth, however, they have continuing decrease in PC shipments. But the big surprise is Microsoft. They're fifth in PC shipments, with major increases in PC shipments. The bad news is Acer and Asus and all the others that continue with decrease in PC shipments. Overall, PC shipments have made a turnaround. Your Facebook posts can reveal if you're depressed. Facebook's 2.2 billion active users use the platform for sharing all kinds of information. And researchers reported this week that the words you post in your status updates could also contain hidden information about your mental health. In an issue of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, scientists analyzed language from study participants' Facebook status updates to predict future diagnosis of depression. The researchers say their technique could lead to a screening tool that identifies people in need of mental health support and formal diagnosis, while raising serious questions about health privacy. If this sounds familiar, you're not imagining things. Scientists have been studying the association between Facebook and the mental state of its users for years, often without the consent of people being the examined subjects. Earlier this decade, scientists at Facebook and Cornell conducted a study which targeted the moods and relationships of more than 500,000 Facebook users without their knowledge. More recently, Cambridge Analytica used ill-gotten data from some 87 million Facebook users to develop personality profiles it claimed would enable marketers and political campaigns to deliver more effective advertisements. A University of Pennsylvania psychologist studied whether language on Facebook could predict a depression diagnosis. He and his colleagues needed access to two personal forms of data: social media accounts and electronic medical records. Over the course of 26 months, they approached more than 11,000 patients in a Philadelphia emergency department and asked if they'd be willing to share their EMRs and up to 7 years' worth of Facebook status updates. Some, believe it or not, 1,200 patients agreed. Of those, 114 had medical records indicating a depression diagnosis. Every year, roughly, one in six Americans suffer from depression. They found that people with depression use more I language, that is to say, a first-person singular pronoun, and words reflecting hostility and loneliness in the months preceding their clinical diagnosis. By training the algorithm to identify these language patterns, the researchers were able to predict future depression diagnosis as much as 3 months before its appearance in their medical records as a formal condition. The researchers' observation that depressive individuals use I language more often jibes with findings from past studies, including ones that have related social media usage pattern to self-reported depression. But this is the first study to compare the language people use on Facebook to clinical diagnosis using medical record data. That's an important advance, as a research psychologist at the University of Arizona, who studies how language usage can reflect a person's psychological condition. But the conditions are still far from perfect. The algorithm probability of detecting symptoms of true depression, he says, was higher than the probability of a false alarm, but nowhere near enough for it to replace a formal diagnosis. Remember, the computer is only as smart as the person who programmed it. In order for the Internet of Things to succeed, the two giant semiconductor companies, Advanced Risk Machines, otherwise known as ARM, and Intel, have agreed to work together to use common standards. Britain's ARM, which is a unit of Japan's SoftBank Corp, said it has struck a strategic partnership with Intel to use common standards developed by Intel for managing IoT, or the Internet of Things, devices, connections, and data. Rival semiconductor giants ARM and Intel have agreed to work together to manage networks of connected devices from both firms, clearing a major stumbling block to market growth of the so-called Internet of Things. The Internet of Things involves connecting simple chips that detect distance, motion, temperature, pressure, and images to be used in an ever wider range of electronics such as lights, parking meters, or refrigerators. Some of the world's dumbest electronic devices get smarter by becoming connected into cloud networks, but also harder to protect. Arm's agreement to adopt Intel standards for securely managing such networks marks a breakthrough that promises to drive the spread of the Internet of Things across many industries. An Arm senior vice president and general manager for its Internet of Things Cloud Services division said, "We see significant acceleration in terms of how the market will grow in terms of the number of managed devices and the volume of data that moves through these systems. Arm and Intel have long competed more broadly in processors for computers, networks, and smartphones. Most of the world's biggest suppliers of the Internet of Things chips rely on low-power Arm designs, including NXP, Renesas, and Microchip's Atmel, while Intel, known for its powerful data-crunching processors, dominates the cloud data center market, where the Internet of Things data are analyzed and processed. Chip makers are expected to ship around 100 billion ARM-based Internet of Things devices in the next 4 to 5 years, and this matching the total of ARM chips shipped in the last 25 years. ARM has predicted that as many as 1 trillion Internet of Things devices will be put to work in the world over the next 2 decades. Typically, the Internet of Things devices come preloaded at the factory with network access credentials, leaving them open to many security vulnerabilities. Periodic fixes require manual upgrades by technicians in the field. By allowing their devices to be managed via a single management platform, ARM and Intel are enabling such tasks to be automated to keep them secure. ARM recently introduced Pelion Internet of Things Management Platform will rely on Intel's secure device onboard specifications announced a year ago. This will allow customers using Internet of Things chips based on either company's products to manage them in the same system. This is the weirdest instance of a court case where the loser wins. A U.S. trade judge declined to block the importation of Apple iPhones with chips from Intel Corp, handling a major defeat to Qualcomm in a legal dispute with the iPhone maker. A U.S. International Trade Commission judge said Apple's phones infringe on Qualcomm's patent related to power management technology, but he denied the chipmaker's request for a ban on the import of iPhones into the United States. The administrative judge at the ITC said that public interest factors weigh against granting Qualcomm's request for a ban. The determination will be reviewed by other judges. Qualcomm, the world's largest mobile phone chip maker, has another pending patent case against Apple before the ITC. Apple said in a statement that Qualcomm had unfairly demanded royalties for technologies it had nothing to do with. "We're glad the ITC stopped Qualcomm's attempt to damage competition and ultimately harm innovators and U.S. consumers." And in a statement, Qualcomm General Counsel said the company was pleased that the judge did find patent infringement, but it makes no sense to then allow infringement to continue by denying an import ban. That goes against the ITC mandate to protect American innovators by blocking the import of infringing products. "There are many ways Apple could stop infringing our technology without affecting the public interest." Apple and Qualcomm are locked in a wide-ranging legal dispute in which Apple has accused Qualcomm of unfair patent licensing practices. Qualcomm has in turn accused Apple of patent infringement. San Diego, California-based Qualcomm initiated an ITC case against Apple in July of 2017, alleging that iPhones containing Intel chips infringe 6 patents describing technology that helps smartphones perform well without draining the battery. Qualcomm did not allege that Intel chips violate its patents, but claimed that the way Apple implemented them in the iPhone does. Based on the ITC decision, Intel's general counsel said Qualcomm had publicly disparaged Intel products as inferior to Qualcomm's during the case. It's easy to say things, but Intel's track record is clear. Every day we push the boundaries of computing and communication technologies, and the proof is in the pudding. Last year, the U.S. Patent Office awarded more patents to Intel than to Qualcomm. The ITC is a popular venue for patent disputes because it handles cases relatively quickly and can more easily bar an infringing product from the United States market than federal courts can. Qualcomm dropped 3 of the 6 patents from the case before a trial that began in June. They said that the decision that Apple infringed only 1 of the 3 patents remains in the case. This is the weirdest outcome I've heard of. You're guilty of infringing, but you can continue to, well, ship the equipment in without a ban, and Qualcomm wins but loses. Tonight, Dr. Alfred Poor will be talking about low-cost ultrasound and telemedicine to treat opioid addiction and sun-powered wearables on your skin.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearables and digital health technology from Health Tech Insider.
Among the many miracles of modern medicine, one of the ones that I have to rate highest is medical imaging. X-rays, ultrasound, MRIs, all these different kinds of technologies allow us to peer inside the human body and see what's going on, see it function without having to cut the person open. It's an amazing technology, amazing advance, and gives doctors a huge advantage over figuring out what's wrong with somebody. One of the most interesting technologies in all of this is ultrasound. It just uses sound waves, and it's very benign. This is what we traditionally use to look at human fetuses in the womb because it doesn't injure them or very low possibility of causing any harm. And so ultrasound is preferred over some other forms like X-rays, which can cause damage over time. One of the problems with ultrasound is that it's not readily available. It comes with expensive machines that you have to roll around on carts and can be difficult to use and so forth. Well, researchers at the University of British Columbia have come up with a way to make inexpensive ultrasound devices. It's called a transducer, and because it transmits and receives the sound, and that's how it creates an image. The way you create the sound is you need tiny vibrating devices. Typically, a standard ultrasound device uses piezoelectric devices. These are tiny crystals that vibrate when you run an electric current through them. It's the same type of technology that you use for a lighter for your barbecue, where you click it and it makes a spark. Well, piezoelectrics, if you apply a force, you get electricity. If you apply electricity, you get a force in a form of vibration. And these piezoelectric crystals are not that difficult to make, but it's expensive and it takes a lot of different fabrication processes that you need expensive equipment to create. These folks at the University of British Columbia have come up with a way to make tiny little drums out of plastic. They use a special resin, and they are able to form them into these tiny little drumhead kind of things. And when I say tiny, I mean really tiny. The individual structures are about 50 microns in diameter, which is about the width of a typical human hair. So they make these tiny, tiny little vibrating drums, and it's made out of plastic. It's easier to make. It takes a lot fewer fabricating steps to create them. The result is a transducer that can cost significantly less than the technology that we use today. The transducer itself can be flexible because it's so thin, and so you could actually wrap one around a patient's arm to look at inside from different angles all at once. The cool thing about this is that they're so easy to make and have simple materials that these researchers envision that it would be possible to create a ultrasound device that could cost as little as $100. Now imagine that. It's something that ultimately could be a consumer device that we could buy at the drugstore, or it would also make these imaging technologies available in underdeveloped regions where they don't have access to expensive medical equipment, but they could have these portable, lightweight, inexpensive ultrasound transducers out there in the field so that healthcare workers wouldn't have to send people to a hospital or a clinic that's maybe a day's travel away. They could do the imaging by themselves right there on the spot. So it's still early days on this. It's a laboratory project at this point, but the fact is that it's a breakthrough of sorts and could change the way we do medical imaging in the future. Opioid addiction and abuse continue to be a major problem, not just in this country, but worldwide. According to the CDC, over 63,000 people died from drug overdoses in 2016. They figure about two-thirds of those were due to opioids. So it's a big problem. And one of the major parts of the difficulty is that there are treatments out there that are effective. There's one that's called medication-assisted treatment, in which the patient receives a drug called buprenorphine. It's an opioid derivative and can be used in addiction treatment to help wean a patient off the drugs that they're hooked on. But the problem is that a lot of people feel that you have to be in a clinic in some rehab setting in order to have access to this drug and this kind of a treatment. The Department of Health and Human Services has come up with a way to support this medication-assisted treatment using telemedicine. In this way, a doctor can consult with a patient who's going through the treatment remotely through a video connection. And this can be very important for rural areas where patients may not be able to travel easily to get to a clinical setting where they could get this treatment. This use of telemedicine could greatly expand the footprint for this kind of treatment and bring effective treatment for people who are suffering from opioid addiction and abuse in a much greater area. One of the big problems with wearables is, how do you get power to them? They're digital devices. They require some electricity to power them, to run the sensors, to process the data, to be able to transmit it to something else. And one of the problems is you can use a battery, but if the battery runs down, then it has to be either replaced or recharged. We've talked a lot over the years about energy harvesting, and you can gather enough energy to run some devices just from body heat or from the motion that a person goes through while wearing the device, or even from ambient radio waves, the radio waves that are in our environment around us all the time that we're not aware of. Each of these approaches have advantages and disadvantages, but why not use the same energy source that plants use? In other words, light. Scientists at Riken in Japan, they've been working on some organic solar cells that are so thin that they could be applied to the skin and be flexible enough that they could bend and not be affected by motion. These solar cells are actually fabricated on a substrate that's only 1 micron thick, which is very, very thin. And they have what's called a nanograting, which is a way to concentrate the solar energy that strikes them so that they can be more efficient. In fact, the researchers were able to extract about 10% of the energy from sunlight using this device. So it's very efficient for a thin film device like this. They've discovered that it works well at a lighting level of 10,000 lux, which is about what you would get if you were sitting outside in the shade on a sunny day, on a bright sunny day. That's a reasonable amount of light. One of the things you have to keep in mind, however, is that indoors, you have a lot less light. You might have as much as 1,000 lux over by a window, where that's 1/10 of what you'd have if you were outside, but it can drop to 50 or even 25 lux inside the room or the building where you are. In addition, the device would only work if it's exposed to light, so you couldn't cover it up with clothing, for example. And the researchers themselves point out that you need some sort of storage, a battery or something, to hold the energy for when the light gets interrupted. This is an interesting development, but it's got a long way to go before it'll become a useful device. It could be incorporated with sensors so that you could monitor biometric measures from the person's body, My guess is that it's probably going to work best if incorporated with other energy harvesting technologies, such as motion or heat or something like that. But the whole idea of being able to have wearable sensors that we can apply to our skin like a Band-Aid, and they would power themselves and then be able to wirelessly communicate their data to a source where it could be processed and shared, that's a pretty good idea, I think, and probably where we're headed in the future.
For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. The following is a tribute to Paul Allen, founder and really the brains behind Microsoft. Bill Gates and Paul Allen founded Microsoft together in 1975. Paul Allen passed away this Monday at the age of 65. Paul Allen wasn't content with starting one company. He channeled his intellect and compassion into a second act focused on improving people's lives and strengthening communities in Seattle and around the world. He was fond of saying, "If I had the potential to do good, then we should do it." That's the kind of person he was. Paul loved life and those around him, and we all cherish him in return. He deserved much more time, but his contributions to the world of technology and philanthropy will live on for generations to come. Allen and Gates, both computer enthusiasts, met when they were students at Lakeside School in Seattle at ages 14 and 12. Paul Allen, whose father was associate director of libraries at the University of Washington, spent a good amount of time with Gates and other friends in UW's computer science lab, so much so that he received a letter in 1971 when he was a high school senior, informing him that he would no longer have access to UW's graduate computer lab. It was at UW where Allen and Gates launched their first venture, a startup that developed a computer system to count traffic called Trafodata. As quickly as it started, the business evaporated. But while Trafodata was technically a business failure, the understanding of microprocessors they absorbed was crucial to their future success, and the emulator that Paul Allen wrote gave them a huge head start over anyone else writing code at the time. Paul Allen left the board of Microsoft in 2000 and went on to pursue a variety of other philanthropic and business ventures spanning technology, scientific research, real estate, the arts, and sports. He purchased the NBA Trailblazers in 1998 and the Seahawks in 1996, and was also part owner of a Major League Soccer franchise. He is credited with helping usher the Seahawks to 3 Super Bowl appearances. Allen was also involved in a diverse range of activities, including real estate development, wildlife conservation, and aerospace engineering. In 2003, he launched the Allen Institute for Brain Science and donated hundreds of millions to the organization. In a statement released on Twitter, Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella called Allen's contribution to the company and the industry indispensable. And yes, he was indispensable. He actually was the technician and the brains behind Microsoft, whereas Bill Gates was the mission and leader in the company. Most household ventilation ducts are rectangles or cylindrical tubes made from sheet metal. It also means you're wasting energy in ways that are tough to effectively stop. Marty, can you go into greater detail?
By now, I think everybody here knows that I'm a lazy cheapskate, meaning I have a fondness for measures that can cut my energy bills and at the same time reduce the wear and tear on my HVAC system so it can run for a lot longer before I get stuck with big repair or replacement bills. I'm going to share one of those little tricks with you, but if I just did that, well, you'd have an extra 10 minutes of Hank telling you why the good old days were so good and Joe telling you why he keeps bobbing for apples. So to spare you a little of that and to give them a few minutes for handling other chores, let me get into another of my roundabout explanations, this time about how another set of things works and how it could work better and what difference that makes. And this segment is not just hot air. cold air plays just as big a role. Did I make the air apparent? This is about how the heating and cooling air that comes from your HVAC gets partially blocked and more than a little lost before it does you any good, and how the result of that gooses up your cost of living. Let's call this segment Duct Duct Goose. Yeah, ducts, ventilation ducts. Take them for granted, and other than the cooties that grow inside them, you can pretty much never think about them again. Only, after you hear what's really happening inside them, you may find it pretty hard not to think about them. Let's assign just two jobs to your ductwork. One of those is simply to move air from the blower in your HVAC system to the register in the wall that delivers the air to your room. The other is to get the air to take that trip without losing its ability to heat or cool that room when it gets there. The chances are pretty good that the ducts you have now are not getting passing grades in either one. So, let's start with the job of moving air. How could that possibly go wrong, right? Well, leaks are one way. Even if you can't see big holes in your ducts, I'll bet you a cupcake that there are so many little leaks that you might as well just have one big hole. Every time there's a junction, odds are that the two pieces of metal don't perfectly marry. Did the installer put some of that silvery tape on those join points? Goody! Does the tape go all the way around or just partway? Oops. And when the ducts get to that register in the wall, do you know what's behind the wall? It's called a boot. It adapts the shape of the vent duct to the shape of the register, and it's not too unusual to find a right angle turn involved. That's not what you should worry about. You should worry about the gaps where it all joins together. Same thing. If there's tape, it may not be all the way around, and its edge may have lifted. You could be doing almost as good a job of heating and cooling the attic or inside the wall as you are of helping the room be comfortable. Ideally, the ducts should be a perfect path from the big fan in the blower box, the air handler, where all the push, all the air pressure that makes ventilation happen is originating. A perfect path from there to that little slotted plate in the wall of the room where the air comes out needs to be a perfect path. Every time there's a gap, every time the path is less than completely sealed, you lose a little of that push, a little of that pressure. The HVAC has to work harder and run longer just to get enough warmed or cooled air out the other end to get the temperature of the house where you want it. There are answers to sealing that path. We'll get there in a few minutes. But while we're talking about getting the air from one end to the other, there's another factor most people never think to consider. Are your ducts round or rectangular? Round is better for kind of the same reasons that curved wing surfaces are why airplanes can fly. When you push air along a rectangular cross-section, just think of a rectangle when air is trying to get down the middle of it. Well, you may have a central radius of even flow, but the corners create little detours for the airflow. The air bounces as it travels, and that turns into phenomena you may recognize, whirls and eddies. Those aren't polite artifacts. They work against the forward airflow. They create some blocking. Even worse, they create back pressure. That back pressure goes all the way back to the air handler in the HVAC system, where it increases the loading of the system. And you may have done some things that really exacerbate that, really make it a lot worse. Just think, have you ever tried to help more heating or cooling get to some parts of your house by totally closing down the register dampers or the vent dampers to other parts of the house? That also creates back pressure. And the Street Smart HVAC repair guys I talked to about all this tell me that back pressure is a very common cause of something in the system blowing out. Those are never small repair bills. If you're sensing a little bit of a cascade effect here, you're right. And all caused by something as dumb as ventilation ducts. I'm going to give you part of the answer now, but stick around because there's a whole other aspect of this that can really save you some money and some grief. Okay, sure, you probably figured out that round ducks are better than rectangular ducks, but that's really an oversimplification. Don't get metal ducks. First of all, tariffs have already kicked their prices up 3 times just this year. Second, the way round metal ducks are made and the way they're joined still lets gaps happen. Third, they only know how to turn corners squarely, abruptly, suddenly, which brings, well, it brings on more of those eddies and whirls. So part of the answer is to go with flexible round ductwork, which is something like a wide hose built around a slinky-like helical spring. Those pieces of round ductwork can adjust for length just by pushing, and they mate with a tight seal. You can add some of that silvery tape if you want, but it's not do or die. Here's what is do or die. Bring in one of those Street Smart HVAC guys to figure out which diameters to use for runs of what length where. That's not trivial and not something that a do-it-yourselfer tends to ever get right. A pro can figure that out, figure out the junction or transition pieces you need, and figure out the path, pretty much following the ducts you have now, but allowing softer curves in the line to help prevent back pressure. A pro is also going to be a lot better and a lot less likely to get hurt when tearing out the old ducts. But like I said, don't go there yet. There's another important point here. Energy you pay for is how the air that's blowing gets either hot or cold, as appropriate. But you waste energy and make the system run too long if the air coming out of the registers isn't as hot or as cold as when it started. Should you insulate? Well, it's almost impossible to add insulation to runs of ductwork in any way that's totally effective. But who said it's you who has to add the insulation? There are some companies like Thermaflex that manufacture round, flexible ductwork with a cross-section that looks more like a donut with a layer of insulation surrounding the inner polymer duct and maintained within an outer jacket that also acts as a vapor barrier. That has a lot going for it. For one thing, you don't get condensation when you run air conditioning, stopping those water drips that can do their own kind of damage. And for another, you don't suffer the same kind of delivery path heat loss. There are different kinds of insulated double wall round flexible ductwork, even within any one brand. These different kinds all reduce the acoustic noise of air conditioning, and it will seem like the system runs more quietly. Some of them offer flame resistance, some prevent cooties, I should say microorganisms, from growing. So, am I suggesting that you pay to tear out your existing ventilation ducts and replace them with this insulated, double-wall, flexible, round ductwork? Well, I'm suggesting you think about it. Let me offer some numbers that I believe will hold true for you. For an existing single-family residence in a 2,000 to 3,000-square-foot realm, depending on what kind of good, better, best choice of ductwork you decide to make, the cost of materials, just the materials, might run, somewhere between $400 and $800. Good, better, best, and, the length will get bigger as the floor plan gets bigger. Plus, you'll be spending another $500 to $600 in labor, so bookend it somewhere between $900 and $1,400. What's the payback? Approximately 30% of your monthly heating and cooling energy bills, all because of getting better sealed, better insulated ducts. And these are ducts you may never have to replace at all, maybe once in the next 40 years. You get those savings by making the airflow reach where it's intended to reach without losing air along the way, and by making sure it didn't lose its warm or its cool along the way. But that's not the big win. The big win is in delaying an expensive HVAC system repair or replacement. Your system is wasting less energy, running more efficiently, seeing less of a load, enduring a lot less wear and tear, and just plain cruising without the bruising. Oh, yeah, your home will be more consistently comfortable, too, meaning that when you're working at the computer, it's not going to see extreme temperature, so even your computer might be cruising a little, too. Even so, it's still a good idea to back up, back up, back up.
Thank you, Marty. public service announcements, computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. All these meetings are free and open to the public. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. The Princeton PC Users Group will have a presentation on home automation Tuesday, October the 23rd. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet in the community room, Princeton Public Library, 65 Witherspoon Street in Princeton, New Jersey. The Brookdale Computer User Group will have a presentation on updated tips for staying safe online. Thursday, October the 25th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m., and they meet at the Middletown Library Computer Lab at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. The Westchester PC User Group will have a presentation on computational knowledge engine Wolfram Alpha. Meeting time is Thursday, November the 1st at 7 p.m. They meet at the Keller Williams Realty at 120 Bloomingdale Road, first floor, White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets on Friday, November the 2nd at 8 p.m. at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society has a meeting on Tuesday, November the 6th, 7:30 p.m., and they meet at 24 Hospital Avenue in Danbury, Connecticut. The New York Amateur Computer Club has a meeting on Thursday, November the 8th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, room 411 in Manhattan, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group has a meeting on Friday, November the 9th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Harry J. Scherr Hall, New York Institute of Technology in Old Westbury Campus, out in Old Westbury, New York. Computer Learning Center at Ewing, they have a presentation on new technology toys for the holidays, Tuesday, December the 4th. Meeting time is 1:30 p.m., and they meet at 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. I hope we'll be seeing you at one of these club meetings. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm on the Internet and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York on the radio or WBAI.org streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing. And back up, and, well, don't forget to back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.